So they looked at each other and they started talking in Arabic to each other. I don't know what they're saying. And they probably said, "We'll beat the pants off these Jews." So they said, "Okay, we'll play." So they thought we were going to be on different teams. I said, no, we're going to be on teams together. I said, Ananiel, remember Ananiel at this point was like maybe 7 years old. I said, Ananiel, you're going to be on, and my kids are looking at me like, I'm not going to even beat him? I'm going to have to like root for him to win with me? This is ridiculous. So I actually split us up on, you know, teams. And we started playing soccer with each other. And I have to tell you, it was the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful moments of my life, to hear Ananiel screaming, "Mohmad! Mohmad! Over here! Over here!" It was so cute. You know, "Mohmad! Come on, Mohmad!" Right? And it was really very beautiful. And the sad thing is that, unfortunately, most of these kids just grew up being taught hatred. So I just feel bad for those kids, right? Now, if one of those kids try to kill me, I'll kill that kid, but I feel very bad about it, right? So you can't help yourself. You know, you start talking about hatred towards these groups that hate us. And Amalek, Rav Kook actually says that it says in the Torah that you have to wipe Amalek out from beneath the sun. The Kabbalah teaches it by raising him above the sun, right? It says, wipe out Amalek from underneath the sun by raising him above the sun. Okay? So it is complicated because Amalek is really the essence of evil. Right? And hopefully the individual who happens to be a member of Amalek could somehow... But Amalek, for good reasons, is really, at this point, totally theoretical. We have no clue who Amalek is anymore, and we're probably never going to know who Amalek is anymore. And that's God's planning too. I think it's all part of this process of distillation as evil becomes more an entity rather than a person, right? And hopefully more and more we'll be able to discern the difference between the person and the evil. But I want you to know, Laura, the kinds of stuff you're hearing deeply disturbs me, right?
Well, me too.
Right? So could you stop hearing that? I'm just joking. Right. Well, look, again, you employ hatred towards evil. And, of course, it's practically very difficult to discern the evil from the person. But what disturbs me is I find that when rabbis speak about this, we have to take inventory of how much do we need to be speaking about this. And how helpful is that? And really what inspired me to call Israelite, Israelite, I was inspired by a statement of Rav Kook that said that the righteous, rather than focusing on darkness, they add light. And what I felt a little bit too much in the Jewish education that I was getting was it seemed to focus a lot on darkness. Either the darkness and pain of our history or the darkness of those others that try to hurt us, or whether it's the darkness in other philosophies or religions. And I kind of felt that there was too much of a message of what everyone was not, and not so much of the message of, well, what are we? And so when I read that statement from Rav Kook, that sense of light really struck me, that today, really, all the more so today, has to be a teaching of light and love. And the more you add love, the more love will come. Now, I'm not saying you don't have to sometimes go to war. You have to go to war, but it should really pain you to have to do this, right? Not be thrilled by it.
I think that it's thinking the other way.
Okay, look. It does teach us that Hashem created a Yetzirah. There is within us a negative, destructive, ego, self-centered spirit called the Yetzer Hara. It's important to understand that there's something also called the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination. The Maharal, who was one of the great philosophers of the Jewish people, he points out the difference that one is called the Yetzer Hara, right? And the other one's called Yetzer Tov. not Yetzer HaTov. Why? So really, they've been loosely translated as evil inclination and good inclination. That is a poor translation. Really, Yetzer Hara would be the inclination for evil, and Yetzer Tov would be the good inclination. What would be the difference between a bad inclination or an inclination towards bad? What would be the difference?
It's like making the bad as an actual entity versus making it like something that we actually have power over, because it's not even us. We're choosing.
Ah, okay, you're in the right direction. Want to add more to this? Yeah.
Well, the good inclination is, sounds like it's more of the essence, coming from the essence of us. It's the good inclination, whereas the inclination for evil is sort of not really from the essence of us.
Wow. Actually, it's a little bit, not the opposite, but that's not quite so. You see, good inclination means the inclination in and of itself is good. The inclination for evil means it's not the inclination that's bad, but it inclines towards evil. But in its root, even the inclination for bad is good. In its root. Inclined to evil. For instance, the metaphor of water and fire. Fire isn't bad, but it has an inclination towards destruction. Because if we drop a match on the tablecloth, the whole place could go up, right? But if we drop a drop of water on the tablecloth, it just gets absorbed. So water in Jewish tradition is analogous to the good inclination, and fire is analogous for the inclination towards evil. But the inclination in itself is not bad. It's just volatile and easily misused and misdirected. Okay, so as I mentioned, hatred's not bad. It's what you hate. If you hate evil, right, well, that was really good. And all the more so if you hate evil because you love God, then your hatred for evil is actually a manifestation of love. Okay? So it's all about, you know, how our energies within us are being directed. Okay? So, but the Talmud does say our evil inclination, our inclination for evil is quite a challenge. Because the Talmud says that the Yetzer Hara, I'd rather just refer to it as the Yetzer Hara, is like a fly. That's what it says. That's what it says in the Talmud. It's like a fly. Why? Because what is the character of a fly? The room could be immaculately clean, but a fly comes in there and finds the dirt behind the refrigerator. It just always finds the dirt. So your life could be really pretty good, but the Yetzer Hara always just harpers on that little bad part of things, that little dark, dirty part, and just keeps you focused there. Okay? And it's a real challenge that people just see the negative just faster than they see the positive. And everything could be wonderful, and they point to, but that. If only that flower were just a little, then everything would be fine. But like, why do you go to the that? But that is part of the Yetzer Hara. And it is a very serious challenge. Now, Torah says that Barati Yetzer Hara, Barati Torah Tavlin. I created, Hashem says, a Yetzer Hara, and I created as its Tavlin, which has been loosely translated as its cure, Torah. But the word Tavlin actually means spice. So what would that mean? Torah doesn't come to destroy your Yetzer Hara, but actually to spice it up so it's edible and you can really do something with it. Right? It says in the Torah, Mi hagibor, who is truly strong, hakovesh et yitro, one who conquers their inclination. It doesn't say one who kills their inclination, but rather conquers their inclination. So we really are that crane. Within us, there is this dynamic where there is this real strong pull towards egocentricity, towards being really pedantic and obsessive over details, seeing them outside the context of the whole. And then there's this other pull, right, which is towards wholeness, goodness, soulfulness. And we experience ourselves to be a conflict. And Rav Soloveitchik talks about this in some of his writings, that we are conflict. We are a conflict. Now, you could either go crazy about that, or you could do something about that. Because imagine you were a car, but you didn't know you were a car. Okay? And then someone turns you on, and you start experiencing these explosions within yourself. Because really, what is a car? A car is propelled by explosions, combustion. So imagine this car feeling, oh my God, I gotta go see a therapist. Because I'm just explosive. Because I'm full of combustion over here. Right? But the truth is that if you know how to guide the combustion, it would propel you forward. Okay? So you're right. We are combustive beings. Animals just go with their flow. But we are intention. There's who I am, and yet there's always who I think I ought to be, and somehow I'm trapped between who I am and who I feel I ought to be. I don't think animals have this sense of, gee, I ought to be a tiger, but I'm just a pussycat. I mean, maybe in Disney characters, but basically, we're just projecting our baggage on these poor little animals, you know? But essentially, we are combustive beings. And there's a reason for that, right? Because if the car would say, just disconnect me, right? Like, take the gas out of me, and I don't want to live this way, then you'd no longer get anywhere. So you have to understand, the most combustive people are the most highly propelled, upwardly motivated, upper motion people. Okay? I read this one quote where nobody who's ever done anything great in this world had an easy life. Right? It's really the difficulties that build us. And so, yes, we really say, well, how come there's such a strong drive to the negative, to the hateful, to the, right? Because that creates the setting for really serving God. I mean, if you were good, and you were naturally good, to serve God and bring goodness in the world, is that a service to God? But if you really have a strong inclination towards doing bad, and you harness that, and you turn that power around, and you choose to do good, wow, that would be a service. Right, that would be a service. So, and I think that was one of the great, great revelations that Judaism brought to the world. Is yes, Yetzer Lev Adam Ra Minurav, the verse says, that the inclination in the heart of man is evil at his very birth, at his childhood. And Judaism was warning us that there is this inclination for evil. And you got to take it seriously, because if you don't take it seriously, then it'll take you over. And you need, you know, if you knew you were going to battle, then you'd bring out the big guns, and you know that life needs some very serious life strategies. I noticed someone forgot their Dr. Phil in the bathroom, called Life Strategies. And I don't understand why. You're listening to David Aaron, you're reading Dr. Phil, right? But then I said, it's in the can. When I see it, if I see the secret life of God in the bathroom, I'll get worried. But and I looked at the back of the book, and Dr. Phil is quite a brilliant man, but he's not the first one that came up with life strategies. Judaism offered the world, a pagan, primitive, uncivilized world, life strategies. I would describe Judaism as probably the movement of human civilization. See, the problem for us to really appreciate Judaism, because we live in a basically civilized world. So we kind of like assume it was always civilized. Right? But if you go back, and you see these guys sacrificing their children on altars to their gods, right? And suddenly there's an Abraham who's talking love and talking abstract God. Then you say, whoa, we were a total quantum leap. The Rambam in his book, Mor Nevuchim, really describes Judaism as the movement, the original movement of civilization, civilized human beings. Until then, we were just apes amongst apes. We were worse than apes. Because apes are nicer to each other than human beings are, you know? And so this movement of civilization, this training oneself to a higher order, right, revealing the soul, has been the life strategy of Judaism. And any life strategy needs persistence and commitment and hard work and techniques and exercises, right, and anything that you're going to really succeed at. But that's how you get to it. It's like, you know, the metaphor that was shared with me is, and I might have shared this with you, imagine you're sitting at a jazz concert and you're just so moved by the brilliance of this saxophone player. He's just going, boo, 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 and you're like, wow, that's what I want to be. I want to be a jazz saxophone player. And the way these guys just jam and they do that improvisational stuff and they're just so in beat with each other. It's just so exciting. I want that too. So you go up to the guy and says, man, you're great. How do I become like you? So he says, well, go to the school I went to in the Kentucky Jazz School. I say, okay. So I go to the Kentucky Jazz School and I'm so excited because I'm going to be a jazz player. And I sit there in the first class and it's like, oh my God, this is terrible, this is boring. And there's all this jazz theory that I have to memorize. And then they start giving us these exercises, you know, and I'm for like hours a day I'm going, you go like, when am I going to get to the jazz? When am I going to, you know, and you realize this takes years of real practice. Real discipline. You come home at the end of the day, your fingers are in so much pain, and you've got those things on your calluses and blisters on your fingers, and you're just like, I want to be a jazz player. So you go back to this guy and you say, hey, Mr. Jazz Man, like, how do I get over this stuff? And he says, hey, man, that's what I did, and it's the only way. If you really want to play, right? And so there's a lot of work. There really is a lot of work in life. We are a piece of work, and we have a lot of work to do. But what's so fascinating is so many of these ideas that you find in these self-help books. They were here all along. It was just like maybe they didn't think they should teach us that in Hebrew school, but right, and then the. To me, the real advantage is I'm part of a movement that is moving towards spiritual health. I'm part of a historic movement, right? And I'm part of a community, a historic community, that is being committed to the highest standards of living morality and ethics. Did they all succeed? No. Right? Yeah.
So the question is, if getting to know really who you are is really knowing Hashem, how do you really know? I'm constantly in that inner turmoil of I really don't know, and I would love to know
what you can trust within your mind or your soul to know who you are so you can actually keep building that versus the things that can make you crazy and that are really not good for you. How do you know if you can't trust this or this?
Well, it's definitely a challenge. Actually, in number five, we've got a little bit of the beginning of that answer, because Rav Kook explains, Emunah in God is the soil in which all values of life blossom. Everything blossoms from this place of Emunah, which is the basic experience of the essence of soul becoming revealed. But how do I know? Is it the essence of my soul, or am I confused? And that's very, very hard, because let's think of a child, okay? And I'm going to now toilet train my son. And he's two or three or whatever, I forgot what age. Let's say two. And so you're going to come to this child who's a natural, spontaneous, happy-go-lucky kid. And you're going to now say, you see this? Now, goes, And he goes, He looks at you like, you're nuts. What? Let me get this straight? What? Right? You know, there's a, one of our holy books is called Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. So a woman wrote a book for toilet training called Sir HaShirim, which means the pot of all pots. Instead of Shir, Sir. So it's cute, cute little book, because it has a picture of a little boy, and this is how you toilet train your child. Because what happens is they got pictures of him in his diaper and it's all over the place. And the mother goes like, you go like this. And then she comes with this big, beautiful gift wrapped gift. And he opens it up. And he looks at it, and he puts it on his head. So he thinks it's a hat. She says, no. She says, uh-huh. So then he puts a flower in it. And she says, no. And he says that he doesn't get at all. This is totally out of his paradigm. What? And so what is this? What is this great gift? So she explains, and he goes, uh-uh. And he thinks she's totally crazy. And not only that, but do you know what you're going to do to me, mother? Do you understand? Here I am, this happy, spontaneous, flowing child. I do it when I want to do it, how I want to do it. I feel comfortable. I feel natural. I just want to be a natural woman. I just want to be me. You know, doing what comes naturally. I mean, you know, I got all these songs that I've been singing, and now you're telling me to be unnatural? Now you're telling me to do it there? You're going to destroy me. You're going to really destroy all my creative, my creative license. And then, well, but now what do? You use the ancient system called reward and punishment. You say, now, honey, if you do it in the pot, I'll give you a little piece of chocolate. And if you don't do it in the pot, I'll beat the smithereens. No. No, you don't say that, right? If you don't, then I will not give you that little piece of chocolate. So now the kid is really in a dilemma. What do I do? Maybe I could fake it and put some mud in the thing. But how do I get, like, I want the chocolate, but I also want freedom. I just want to be happy. And I don't want to be confined. And I see those adults, like they have to hold themselves till they get one of those rooms that they lock themselves into. I don't want to live that confined life, right? I just carry it with me, So the kid's saying, like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. But the parent says, but remember that chocolate, that Hershey kiss that you're going to get. And this is really a dilemma. Do I give up my naturalness, who I really know I am, and my happy-go-lucky lifestyle for that piece of chocolate? The answer is, you're damn right. That chocolate is more interesting. Right? And so that kid says, okay. And they confine themselves They control themselves. And they get that piece of chocolate. And that reinforces them. Okay, well, so they have a couple of accidents and they feel a little guilty about it and they're hoping they could somehow convince you to still give them the chocolate. And you might say, well, you tried, right? So you'll get half a chocolate. No, you tried, we'll give you. But really, what's going on is the child is going through a process which definitely feels unnatural, confining, restrictive. But when that child finally gets the hang of it, then that actually feels more natural. And suddenly you help me reveal an inner being that I am, a civilized being, right? And I bet you that there is not one person in this room that is coming out of the toilet hoping someone will give them chocolate. Right? Right? Although I have some, if you want, if you need that. But finally, I'm coming out of my shell. It's been a while. But that's exactly what Torah teaches us. In the beginning, there's this idea of reward and punishment. It was all a technique to get you to realize the real reward and the real punishment. Because the real reward is to live a civilized, soulful, sophisticated life. A life that is comparable to who you are as you evolve. And that's the point. Schar mitzvah mitzvah. The reward of a mitzvah is the mitzvah. Okay? The reward of the mitzvah is the opportunity to express emunah. To express who I am, who I'm part of, and why I'm here as a vehicle for that great I am into the world. And therefore, Shabbat, I don't celebrate Shabbat because I think I'm going to get some reward. I remember when I started celebrating Shabbat, and there was a couple of friends that did it, tried to do it together. And then I remember one day, one of our friends didn't show up for the Shabbat, and we wondered what's doing with her. And then the next day, she called me up, she says, "That's it, I'm finished with this." I said, "Yeah, why?" She says, "Because I wanted to see how it would feel doing it by myself." And so I was sitting at home, and suddenly my eyes caught the light switch. And suddenly I wonder what would happen to me if I turn that light switch on Shabbat. And I finally decided, yes, I will. I can. And so I went to that light switch on Shabbat, and I turned it on. And you know what happened? I said, yes. It went on. She said, "That's right, there was no lightning." I said, "I know there was no lightning. You thought there'd be lightning?" She said, "I thought I'd feel something, experience something." But I wasn't punished. But the truth is, she was punished. But she punished herself. Because she basically gave up a way of living that really could have brought her so much peace. So much peace to her marriage, God willing, that hopefully she's married at now, and to her children, to her friends. She would have created a sanctuary in time every week to really come back to herself and get refocused. I really believe that a lot less people would need to go to therapy if they would celebrate Shabbat weekly. You know, and people don't realize that. Even just the opportunity for real friendships that happen on Shabbat. We're not worried about, well, where are we going to go today? What are we going to do? Because we know we can't go anywhere. We don't drive our car, right? And we know that we can drink schnapps and we won't get arrested for drunk driving. So we can drink a couple of chayims on Shabbat. And suddenly there's that opportunity for real being. That's my reward. Right? That's my reward, that connectivity that I afford myself weekly. So the reward of a mitzvah, actually, it says in Pirkei Avot, Schar mitzvah mitzvah, the reward of a mitzvah really is the mitzvah. I mean, what's the reward for living a loving life? It's living a loving life. And that is its own reward. What's the reward of speaking the truth? It's living the truth. That's really the reward. And so it's a hard one because maybe I'm just this little kid that thinks that doing it in my diaper is really so cool and so natural, and that maybe this format that my parents at first seemed to be imposing on me and confining me, restricting me, actually turns into a liberation of my higher soul and an empowerment to be part of a civilized world, right? But it gets deeper than that, because people just don't realize that. I mean, as I mentioned the other day, I really always have, almost always, even though I go back and forth to America a lot, I always have some form of culture shock when I'm in the United States. I'm not saying you don't find some of that here, but I guess when I'm there and I'm walking through Times Square a lot and I'm going to bars and going to discos, I'm just joking. But really, there's like a culture shock because you say, like, what are these people doing to their children? Don't they understand? My wife and children, we were at this amusement park, can't remember where. And, okay, so we thought we'd take the kids. There was this beautiful ice capade, Snoopy and his friends. So we thought, great, we're going to take our kids to Snoopy and his friends. So we went in, and boy, were Snoopy's friends gorgeous. They had no clothing. Like, suddenly, Snoopy's friends came out, and they were like in bikinis. Right? But like, it was like, what is going on? Isn't it cold? I mean, they're on skates. And they are dressed so scantily. I mean, it was like Snoopy's burlesque show. And so my wife and I didn't know what to do. And the kids, and then Snoopy came out fully dressed, poor guy. He's got this huge Snoopy, but his friends were these, like, you know, Playboy pinups. And like, we got to get out of here. So we said to the kids, we have to go. And my son goes, but Snoopy just came out. He says, no, really, really, we'll talk about this later, but we really should go. And so the kids said, well, we'll just look at Snoopy. Right. So we left, right? We left the place. Excuse us. People don't know this big family getting up from the middle of the theater. Excuse us, can we get out? Right? We're getting out of this theater. But the problem is now we have to go get our baby carriage, which you're not allowed to take into the theater. So you have to go out around the building to the entrance to reclaim your baby carriage. So we go back to get our baby carriage, and the guy looks at us. He wasn't Jewish. He wasn't a religious looking personality. He was just the guy working there. He said, you were offended, weren't you? So we said, quite frankly, we were. He said, I'm telling you, there are a lot of people that walk out on the show. And I've told the people who run the show that this is really inappropriate. This is really inappropriate. And it was just like, what are people doing to their kids? What are people doing to their kids? And the overplay of sexuality in the media. I read this article on Britney Spears. I was on the plane. I'm flipping through this article about Britney's new show in Britain. And a guy was writing, don't take your children to the show. It's burlesque. This guy was telling, this is not music. Don't take your kids to, don't let your kids go to see this show. Right? And so she's happy to be toxic. I mean, that's the crazy thing. When albums start being called bad, you know, and songs are, I'm bad, I'm toxic, I'm poisonous, I'm dysfunctional, you know, it's like, well, that's what we're singing about? But added to that, you know what's changed in our culture? Is once upon a time, when I was a kid, the bad guy was the bad guy, the good guy was the good guy, and you were rooting for the good guy. Nowadays, you feel sympathy for the bad guy, right? It's about this guy who set up to do this big heist. He's going to steal the jewels of the prince, and suddenly, you're so impressed with his ingenuity, you're so excited by his bravery. You're sitting in suspense, praying that he make it. right? You're so delighted when he gets into that little rowboat that was waiting there perfectly synchronized as he walks off with the crown jewels, you know, in his shoes. And there he goes as the sun sets and you go, yes! That was the show I just saw last night. But it was like, it's unbelievable. The bad guy is now someone you like, someone you admire, someone you look up to. It's crazy. So that's totally culture shock. So I saw a fantastic advertisement for Hebrew school that had a picture of Moses and a picture of some, you know, superhero that looks like a Spider-Man or the Hulk. And it says, who would you like your children to see as their superheroes? Right? The sad thing is I think a lot of parents went, Spider-Man. And what kind of Jewish name is Moses? Spider-Man. There's a Jewish boy. Spider-Man. That's a Jewish guy. You know? And he makes money. You know? Moses, eh? But, you know, like, what is going on? So if we don't think we need to protect ourselves from the society, it's getting even more and more and more crazy. And we think, well, I'm really in touch with myself and I really know what I want. That's hard for me to know what I want. I'm just so thankful I have an ancient tradition that has really produced some people that I have the most incredible awe for in their sensitivity, in their compassion, in their brilliance, in their commitment to life, their commitment to their family, to community. I'm just so awed. They are really the living image of God. And so I don't know the answer, you know. Sometimes, well, I feel good and maybe Judaism doesn't know as much as I know. It's a hard one. It's a hard one.
But it's not Judaism or not. Like, for me,
no, I know that.
I love Judaism.
Right. But as Rav Kook said, which I think is important.
Knowing what you think you want versus what you don't want. How do you know if you're based on a feeling or your mind?
It's everything, it's all of the above. It's talking to friends, it's talking to a rabbi, it's doing some meditation, it's praying to God. It's a total strategy to hope and pray that you'll get the clarity you need to know what you need to be doing now. So it's a challenge. If it wouldn't be a challenge, it wouldn't be the excitement of life, and it wouldn't be as valuable, you know. It just wouldn't be as valuable. So, you know, and these are hard calls. And as Rav Kook taught yesterday, that if a person did tshuva and they somehow feel this yearning to something in their life, you know, their previous lifestyle. So he said, if it's really a genuine deep yearning, then maybe there's some divine spark there that they have not really released and taken with them and found or revealed in some other kosher way, so to speak. It's like when I first went to yeshiva in my dorm, there is this, I had like this little electric piano that I had in my room, and this fellow one day hears me playing and walks in. He says, oh, you're also a musician? So I said, also, so, oh, you're a musician? He said, well, yeah, I'm a musician. I mean, I'm not doing that anymore. So I said, you're not doing that anymore? He said, no, I threw my saxophone into the sea when I did tshuva. When I repented. So I thought, okay. Well, was it like a hobby? Yeah, a little more than that. Right? So he's kind of like telling you that he wants you to ask questions, but he's not telling you. So I said, well, it's a hobby? Well, a little more than a hobby. Oh, it's like kind of like, were you like in a band? You might say. I said, well, was this professional? He says, yeah, I mean, I did make money doing it. I said, well, did you play with anybody I knew? Right? And he said, well, some. I really don't want to talk about it. I did tshuva. Right? Of course, he wants to talk about it. And so I said, well, who did you play with? And he said, oh, I just did some recording. Okay, who did you record with? He said, the Rolling Stones. I said, you're going to hell. And you should have thrown yourself in the sea and give me the saxophone and I'll sell it. So I said to him, I said, you play with the Rolling Stones? I did tshuva. I said, okay, fine. And I threw it away and I don't play the saxophone anymore. So I'm thinking, I don't know, is that the right approach? That I don't play saxophone anymore? Well, maybe for him in that journey in his life. Because sometimes you gotta kinda go to one extreme to get to the middle. And that's okay. You know, sometimes you're all the way this way, you know, if you're bending, you know, a bar, so, you know, so you bend it this way, and then you have to go all the way that way in order for it to be in the center. Right? I know that very well because as a child growing up with red curly hair and all your friends had straight hair, so the only way I could get my hair to be straight is by combing it in the opposite direction of where I wanted it to be, right? I would comb in the opposite direction, dry it that way, and then comb it in the other way, and then it was perfect. It was totally straight. So, but sometimes that process of spiritual renewal and everything is this back and forth, is this challenge for center. So maybe really, I'm not going to judge this guy, maybe he really needed to throw his saxophone out, but to completely do tshuva, I really think that he's going to have to go find that saxophone, hire a submarine, and go in the middle of the sea. Right? But somehow if Hashem gave you a talent, then do something, right? Do something with that talent, and somehow bring God into people's life with your musical powers, right? So you were playing with the Rolling Stones, now play with Moshi and the Mad Men or something, and do weddings, I don't know, but you'll find great fulfillment there. But really, there are musicians that truly can bring such a spirit, and there is service there. So, that's a challenge. You know, maybe in that point of his life, in the Torah perspective, maybe he had to throw away his saxophone. But in some way, there are divine sparks that we're going to have to retrieve. Aspects of ourselves that we left behind. And we're going to have to bring that integration, and it could take many years, you know, to bring back that integration and be whole in our service. My Rebbe, Shlomo Fischer, who actually grew up in Meir Shearim, and is considered one of the great scholars in the generation, a fellow came to him. He was a newly returned Baal Tshuva, and he was a master pianist. His whole life, he'd been playing piano, and he went to a particular learning center, and the teachers there began to tell him that it was a total waste of time, and that he really should give this up, and he should only learn Torah all day long. So he was really struggling because he had tremendous admiration for these teachers, but he really felt that he'd be leaving a big part of himself behind, and does he have to make that choice to be a Torah Jew? So he came to my Rebbe and asked my Rebbe this, and my Rebbe looked at him in surprise. He says, "I don't understand." He said, "Very soon the Beis Hamikdash, the temple, will be rebuilt, and there's this incredible music and musicians playing in there, and quite frankly, I'm tone deaf, so I won't be able to do much in there, but I'm so happy you can. So, you know, so just don't give it up." So, that was my teacher, and I think these kinds of ideas are not genuinely Jewish in terms of that attitude of cutting people into little figures and everything is just so cut dry and there is no gray in the story. I think assimilation is much more serious than we think, because generally assimilation means to people that Jewish people are assimilating into a non-Jewish world. But really I think there's something much more devastating going on. That there are non-Jewish ideas assimilating into the Jewish people, right? And that these are just not genuinely Torah ways of thinking.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.